Today, how the handling of historic allegations of crimes and abuse by British soldiers might be about to change. And Emma John from The Guardian's new podcast, The Spin, on a big summer for cricket.
It is a personal priority of mine that we get this resolved and we stop this chilling effect that is plaguing veterans who really deserve our care and respect.
Earlier this month, the new Defence Secretary, Penny Mordaunt, said that soldiers who had served in Iraq and Afghanistan would be given a presumption against prosecution. A UN committee criticised the decision, asking the government not to grant amnesty or pardon to troops.
Basically, at the moment, murder, genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes and crimes of aggression have no statute of limitations, which means that they can be tried whenever. And this would effectively introduce a kind of limitation for actions by British soldiers overseas. So they wouldn't be able to be charged 10 years later. So for those soldiers who have been subject to historic allegations, it would all be dropped.
Samira Shackle is deputy editor of The New Humanist and writes for The Guardian. She's been investigating the difficult question of how to tackle allegations of abuse against British soldiers that go back years. A question that has pitted human rights campaigners against those who say that these men and women were serving their country and have been betrayed. People like Conservative MP Colonel Bob Stewart.
I'm ashamed, actually, that our governments, I say governments because I include Labour, Coalition, and our present government, are complicit, because that's the way that our men and women look at it, are complicit in a witch hunt against them.
From The Guardian, I'm India Rackerson. Today in Focus, should soldiers be prosecuted for historical crimes committed during wars? A quick warning before we start. This episode contains recordings and descriptions of physical assault and torture. This is an issue that's being fiercely debated because of Penny Mordaunt's proposal, but it goes back more than 10 years. When did the public first become aware of allegations of abuse against British soldiers in Iraq?
It sort of started happening towards the tail end of the war, the kind of second half of the war in Iraq. Before that, there'd been stories about American troops, but the perception was really that British forces weren't involved. So one of the first cases was this video that came out in the News of the World in 2006. They had been filmed 2 years earlier in 2004.
Oh yes, oh yes, you're gonna get it. Yes, naughty little boys.
And it was a group of British soldiers at a military barracks and they'd pulled in some Iraqi boys. Yes. One of them was under 18 and the others, they were quite young, yes. Really beaten with batons. There's a whole group of soldiers really going at them. And it's being filmed by another soldier who's kind of keeping up a really unpleasant commentary.
Oh, please, don't hurt me!
Where he's sort of egging on the soldiers who are beating them.
It is horrifying, really, the way that these people are being treated. This really sadistic commentary. How did people react to it?
Very negatively. I mean, there was a big outcry in the press in the UK. There was an outcry, obviously, in Iraq, where the video was also released, played on loop on news channels. British flags were burnt outside British barracks in Basra.
What happened to the soldiers in that video? I mean, they're identifiable. You can hear one of them.
So they were referred to the Service Prosecuting Authority, which is the military equivalent of the Crown Prosecution Service. And they decided not to bring charges because it was several years ago and it was battery and that there's a statute of limitations on that, meaning that there's a kind of time limit on how long afterwards someone can serve time for a crime. And they decided it wasn't in the public interest to pursue.
I mean, that is quite astounding, really, isn't it? That you could get away with such a vicious crime.
It's cases like this that human rights advocates can often point to and say, well, you've got video evidence, people are very clearly identifiable, and yet you have the kind of military equivalent of the Crown Prosecution Service saying it's not in the public interest to pursue this charge. And it's kind of quite hard, I think, from an external perspective to see why is that not in the public interest.
And this wasn't the only example of abuse by British soldiers, was it?
No, there were a few cases. There was also Camp Breadbasket. That was a case of kind of really horrific ill treatment of Iraqi detainees. They were kind of being put into humiliating positions, having photographs taken of them. It was torture, basically torture and inhumane and degrading treatment. And again, when the photographs of that came out, there was real revulsion and outrage over it.
And are British soldiers ever prosecuted for their actions?
Yeah, rarely. But the Camp Breadbasket, I think, was such a horrific case, and there was so much photographic evidence that the soldiers there were, but they weren't very stringent sentences given the gravity of the crime. So the soldier who had the longest sentence, I believe, which was 2 years, he had been pictured driving a forklift truck with an Iraqi man bound in a net hanging from the prongs, and his sentence was reduced from 2 years to 18 months.
The last British forces are leaving Iraq after 8 years.
So in 2009, UK forces start to wind down. The war in Iraq is coming to an end. And the Prime Minister at the time, Gordon Brown, launches an inquiry into the war, the Chilcot inquiry.
As I've made clear, the primary objective of the committee will be to identify lessons learned.
But how did he approach the allegations towards British soldiers and alleged crimes?
Gordon Brown sets up the Chilcot inquiry. He really wants to kind of draw a line under this unpopular conflict, differentiate his premiership. At the same time, there are two very high profile allegations of abuse of Iraqi civilians, and separate public inquiries were set up for each. One was the case of Baha Moussa, who was a 26-year-old hotel receptionist who was beaten to death in British custody. The second was known as the Al-Swidi inquiry, and that was over allegations of serious battlefield misconduct by British soldiers. Basically, more and more cases are being brought by human rights lawyers, and by one human rights lawyer in particular called Phil Shiner.
There cannot be impunity for the wanton killing of civilians during the occupation.
And in the words of Bill Rammell, who was Minister for the Armed Forces at the time, who I spoke to, he felt they were at risk of having a really expensive public inquiry for every single allegation. So the thinking within government was, we'll pull all these allegations together, we'll set up a process that can look at them all, we can show that we're taking responsibility for British actions where there was wrongdoing, and we can also, I think a real motivator, which he said to me, was that they wanted to dispatch this idea and kind of prove that there wasn't actually really widespread British misconduct in Iraq.
The two existing investigations continued, but any further complaints would now be investigated by the new Iraq Historic Allegations Team, or IHAT. Although unpopular among the new Conservative-led coalition, they felt they had no choice but to continue it. In 2011, the European Court of Human Rights ruled that the UK had a duty to investigate historic allegations.
So it sat within the Ministry of Defence, but it was theoretically an independent body. And the way it worked was that there were human rights lawyers who kind of had the duty to work on IHAT. So that was Phil Shiner's firm, Public Interest Lawyers, and the human rights law firm Lee Day. So Iraqis who had allegations of abuse would come to them. They would then pass those on to IHAT, where a team of civil servants would look at the written statements, any supporting documents, and decide whether they merited investigation. Those that did merit investigation would be passed on to a team of investigators who were mostly retired police detectives, that kind of thing.
And one of the key issues is that IHAT was set up to investigate the alleged crimes of individuals. But in military law, there's a chain of command. So then it wasn't really looking at institutional failures, was it?
In the case of Iraq, that's particularly pertinent because a lot of the allegations relate to ill treatment in detention. You had a situation where British troops arrived without the proper equipment, without anything really set up, and were detaining thousands, literally thousands of Iraqi men and boys without any kind of proper facilities. Various public inquiries have found that there was really widespread use of what are called the five techniques or the five band techniques. They are hooding, white noise, sleep deprivation, food deprivation, and stress positions. And so these were outlawed by the UK in 1972. They're also illegal under the Geneva Conventions. Institutional knowledge of the ban had kind of been lost because they just weren't included in training manuals. So with IHAT, you had a situation where low-ranking soldiers, who are mostly the people being investigated, might be facing criminal prosecution for something that they had been ordered to do.
Okay, so it makes sense that people felt soldiers were hard done by. And also, this wasn't just a few claims. I mean, over the course of IHAT's existence, there were 3,400 allegations, not all of which were pursued. But what was it like for those individuals who were investigated by IHAT?
So I spoke to one soldier in particular who was one of the only majors to be investigated, Major Robert Campbell. He felt very, very angry, not just with IHAT and the government. He also felt very, very angry with the army. He was accused of murder, and it was over a case when he was in Basra where a teenage boy had died. And there was a widespread practice called wetting, which was a kind of British means of crowd control, where they would force crowds into the river. And this boy drowned on this day when Campbell was overseeing this crowd control. And the allegation was that he had forced him into the water and therefore it was murder. He had maintained that the boy had kind of gone in of his own volition and he'd drowned. He'd been investigated four times by different military authorities and cleared. He got a call from his ex-girlfriend telling him that she'd been visited by some IHAT investigators who were asking questions about Campbell. And that was how he found out that he was under investigation for murder. So he immediately called his commanding officer, got in touch with the army, and he was told, don't worry about it, just ignore it, it's all fine. And that it's really important that this process happens because otherwise Britain might be referred to the International Criminal Court. And he claims the army then disclosed his service records to IHAT without his consent. Also, records of counselling that he'd had for PTSD were also handed over. He had been under investigation for several years over this case by IHAT without being informed. And in that time, he'd been deployed to Afghanistan, where he'd been very seriously injured. He's now permanently disabled. He has damaged hearing now, and he has to walk with a cane. And he felt very strongly that he wouldn't have gone had he known that he was under investigation for murder again.
So public sympathy was shifting towards the soldiers. And then in 2014, there was the conclusion of one of the original two investigations, the Al Swidi inquiry. And even though it was separate to IHAT, it was kind of fundamental to IHAT's downfall, wasn't it?
The Al Swidi inquiry, it was over some armed combat called the Battle of Danny Boy. And the allegation was that there had been a series of quite serious abuses by British soldiers, culminating in the murder and mutilation of nine Iraqi detainees. And it was incredibly lurid. And so the verdict from the public inquiry came out, and it was that the central claim was completely untrue and that there had been mistreatment of these detainees, but the murder and mutilation just hadn't happened and the serious battlefield crimes just hadn't happened. And so this was a huge, huge scandal. This is obviously an incredibly expensive public inquiry. I think it cost something to the tune of £31 million.
The Iraqi detainees, their accomplices and their lawyers must now bear the brunt of the criticism.
Michael Fallon, who was Defence Secretary at the time, really, really went on the offensive.
This, in fact, was a shameful attempt to use our legal system, to attack and falsely impugn our armed forces.
And the lawyers who were involved, and this is really important, were Phil Shiner's public interest lawyers and Lee Day, who are exactly the same lawyers who are working on IHAT.
We will never again, in any future conflict, let those activist, left-wing, human rights lawyers harangue and harass the bravest of the brave, the men and women of our armed forces.
That was Theresa May talking in October 2016. And by then, the mood had really hardened against IHAT and the lawyers involved. And in February 2017, there was a solicitor's disciplinary tribunal. Whilst Lee Day successfully defend themselves, Phil Shiner was found guilty of multiple professional misconduct charges, including dishonesty and lack of integrity, and he was struck off. The scandal led to a damning Defence Committee report on IHAT, and the day after it was published, Michael Fallon, the Defence Secretary at the time, announced the investigation team would be closed.
We're able to do that because most of these allegations now fall away following the striking off of the dishonest solicitor.
It all kind of got tarred with the same brush and viewed as, you know, none of this can really be trusted. It's all untrustworthy. It's all spurious. It's all unfair. We should get rid of all of it.
So people, I suppose, started to believe that the testimonies of Iraqis could be false. What do we know about how accurate the claims were? that were coming into IHAT.
With the IHAT claims, in many cases, there is hard evidence. So there's video evidence of interrogations. They've got photographs. They've got contemporaneous medical records. So there is corroborating evidence for a lot of those cases. It's not all just Shiner's testimony. There's also the quite famous case of Baha Moussa, who is a 26-year-old hotel receptionist who was in British custody and he was tortured and beaten to death.
Baha Moussa died with 93 wounds on his body. Soldiers had failed to observe the Geneva Conventions.
The Baha Moussa inquiry, which launched at the same sort of time as the Al Swidi inquiry, found really gross misconduct by British forces.
My judgment is that they constituted an appalling episode of serious, gratuitous violence on civilians, which resulted in the death of one man and injuries to others.
So IHAT was finished. However, the International Criminal Court in late 2017 found sufficient evidence of wrongdoing by the British military to merit further investigation. They are currently deciding whether the UK is willing or able to investigate allegations of war crimes against itself. They've highlighted the political situation in the UK surrounding the decision to drop IHAT. Of the 3,400 allegations, only around 20 were continued. And there are now fears that these will be closed down after Penny Mordaunt's intervention.
In any large organisation, things will go wrong and people must be held to account if they break the law. And in some instances, that has taken place. But it has to be a balanced approach.
Tory MP Johnny Mercer, himself a former soldier, accepts that this is a thorny issue. But he says he wants members of the military to be protected and believes IHAT has let those individuals down.
Watching them go through this process is pretty heartbreaking. You know, there are individual cases where things have gone wrong and they haven't been investigated properly. But on the whole, and looking at the whole thing from a broader context, the response against our veterans and our service personnel has been a complete betrayal by the legislature and by Parliament in this country. So I think now, after the last 2 or 3 weeks, I do feel we are beginning to change the weather on this.
So let's look at the last few weeks. Can you outline for us what legislation the government is currently proposing?
So what the government's currently proposing is, after a certain timescale, and that is being consulted on at the moment, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, whatever it is, after that period of time, you know, there's two sides to a prosecution. One is the evidence and one is the public interest. After that period of time has elapsed, there will be a statutory presumption against prosecution. And what that means is that the evidential threshold is just ever so slightly raised.
And this proposal, this new proposal, doesn't include allegations against soldiers during the Troubles in Northern Ireland. How do you feel about that?
Well, I understand it. I can also understand the anger from people in this country who, you know, at the end of the day, for people who serve there, it feels like a war. It smells like a war. It looks like a war, and it felt like a war to a lot of people. The trouble is the way the UK government legislates for operations, it was deemed as a military assistance to the civil authority. And, you know, we can't sort of go back and change that. So we need to look at that challenge and work out how we achieve a similar outcome for those who served on operations outside of the United Kingdom.
And I'm sure you'd agree with me on this, Johnny. But if I think about some of the videos that have come out of Iraq, some of the abuses that we all saw, you know, that were sort of dripping out of torture, of beatings of civilians, like pretty visceral, hard to watch stuff. Something has gone very wrong there, surely.
You're absolutely right. And it's a very fair point that actually one of the biggest problems with this was the military's inability to investigate itself properly and the standard of those investigations. And it is that precise point which has been challenged by other lawyers. And I totally understand that. And this behaviour has been totally unacceptable. And the military has, you know, a role to play in this as well. And can't just blame everybody else. If those investigations were done properly and self-regulation had occurred, we probably wouldn't be here today.
Samira, it's clearly really difficult to obtain evidence from a war zone. I suppose especially years after the alleged incident has occurred. But is there also a sense that it's not for others to question what happens in the fog of war, if you like?
This idea that civilians don't have the right to challenge what happens in the fog of war, which you do see in certain sections of the press, it's profoundly undemocratic, actually. That's the reason that we have laws governing conflict, because we believe in human rights. We believe that there should be reasonable standards upheld, whether we're participating in an overseas conflict or not. And the other thing that I think is really important in the kind of fallout over IHAP and the fact that it was such a public failure and it was this real kind of nitty-gritty over what did the lawyers do, these big questions about accountability have kind of been lost. So we haven't really answered the question of who bears responsibility for crimes committed in war. It's arguably very politically convenient for the Ministry of Defence that there has been such a turning tide in public opinion on this, and that we now see historic allegations inquiries as bad, because it means that you've also kind of stopped calling for any look at the systemic problems. We're 15 years after the Iraq War. We haven't had any kind of real public reckoning about those questions. That is a real tragedy from what a massive failure IHAP was.
Samira Shackle, thank you very much.
Thanks.
An MOD spokesperson said that IHAT investigations were subject to the highest level of scrutiny, including regular and detailed progress hearings in the High Court and an independent review. Sir David Calvert-Smith, former Director of Public Prosecutions, found no major flaws with the investigating process. Officers of very senior ranks were interviewed in many IHAT investigations when the evidence and the line of inquiry required it, and no investigation was shut down prematurely. You can read Samira Shackle's full piece and follow the story at theguardian.com. Coming up, the podcast that's getting cautiously excited for a summer of wall-to-wall cricket. Welcome back. Now, like any England fan who grew up with the English cricket team in the 90s, Emma John, the host of The Guardian's new cricket podcast, The Spin, is a natural pessimist. So she's finding it hard to deal with England being the favourites to win both the World Cup and the Ashes this summer. But for any doubters, here she argues that cricket is a sport that's easy to fall in love with.
June sees the long-awaited start of the Ashes series at Old Trafford, on a surface made damp by Manchester rain.
So I first fell in love with cricket in 1993, when England were playing Australia in the Ashes, and I knew absolutely nothing about it. And this is proof of how quickly the game can get you. I became obsessed with this sport over the course of, I think, two test matches.
That's a fine shot.
I remember the first one that I watched, I was just looking at figures on a screen, running up and down, dressed in white.
Five duck balls and suddenly concedes three.
Absolutely no clue what was going on.
Top edge.
I was 14 years old at the time, and I was asking my mum a lot of questions, because my mum's a big cricket fan. And the amazing thing about cricket is that every answer you get will prompt another question. So long as you're sitting next to somebody who knows about cricket, you can get into it very fast.
Oh, he's gone. Second attempt. Wow, I thought he dropped it. So is David Williams.
Lords, as always, is the venue for the second Ashes test.
The moment that really stuck with me and pretty much, I think, won me over to the game was watching a player called Mike Atherton, who was England's captain at the time, getting run out on 99 at Lord's.
98. 99. Will they go for the third? He's fallen, he's slipped down. Oh, tragedy, tragedy.
And he basically fell over in the middle of the pitch. And I think that's what really kind of made this game not so much a matter of the head to me, but a matter of the heart. Because if in professional sport you could have this moment of utter tragedy just because you slipped and your leg had gone out from under you, that was the kind of sport that I could understand.
Oh dear, like running in a nightmare with the feet wrapped up in blankets. Going nowhere. 99 run out, but a brilliant innings.
within 2 test matches, and by the end of that summer, I was so obsessed that I was cutting out pictures of cricketers and sticking them on pieces of A3 card and laminating those pieces of card and putting them up on my wall. That's how bad it got. It's the first moment in a long time that cricket will have had such an exciting and potentially really successful summer. The England team have been good for a while now, but the one-day team is for the first time in with a real chance of winning the World Cup. This World Cup is going to be a World Cup where records get broken, where batsmen hit enormous sixes out of the ground, and where bowlers have to bring in all their skills and wiles and speed, particularly, in order to even up the contest. It's going to be very dramatic cricket, this. England play their first game against South Africa, and that is a big game. South Africa are a team who, like England, have some exciting fast bowlers and some very big hitting batsmen. And I do think that if England have a good game, win that and show everyone what they've been showing us for the last year or so, what they're capable of, then people can really get excited about them and their prospects. As a teenager who got into this sport when England were tremendously bad at it, I had to sit through a lot of years of them doing very poorly, and particularly, in fact, in World Cups. They have an absolutely atrocious record in World Cups, including, infamously, the last time England hosted the tournament in 1999, when they played so badly that they managed to actually go out of the tournament before the official World Cup song had even been released into the charts. So we're talking that kind of that level of incompetence and ineptitude and dismal, you know, experiences for fans. But if they win this one, I will have officially completed the set. I will have seen them win a 2020 World Cup. I will have seen them win the Ashes home and away, and beaten all number of major test nations. This is the one thing that neither I nor, in fact, any other England fan has ever seen, is the England men lifting the ICC World Cup. So, you know, it's a big summer for all of us who've been hanging in there for this, and this is their best opportunity in a generation.
And you can hear more of Emma John all summer on The Guardian's new podcast, The Spin. That's all for today. Thanks so much for listening. And do keep letting us know what you think by leaving us a review. My thanks to Emma John and to Samira Shackle and Johnny Mercer. Today's episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin and Joshua Kelly. The sound design is by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.